bring us. Caspian felt sure that he would hate the new tutor. But when the new tutor arrived about a week later, he turned out to be the sort of person it is almost impossible not to like. His name was Dr. Cornelius.
Of all his lessons with Dr. Cornelius, the one that Caspian liked best was history. Up till now, except for nurses' stories, he had known nothing about the history of Narnia, and he was very surprised to learn that the royal family were newcomers in the country.
Welcome to A Sacred Fellowship. This is episode 172, where your hosts, Catherine Olson and Lorianne Schwenk, are discussing chapter 4 of Prince Caspian through the theme of alienation. We are using traditional, ancient, and diverse sacred practices to discern everyday themes in the world of Narnia. We are using these stories to learn, to reflect on our lives, and to think about life's big questions.
Take a seat at the top of this tower or settle in your car and join us. Reading in community is an essential part of what it means for us to treat a text as so sacred, and we're glad you're here to continue building fellowship with us. We believe that by finding the sacred in these writings of Lewis, we will learn to treat one another as sacred.
Hello, Catherine.
I'm
It's
going
been
to break
10
into
days, I think.
musical because it is appropriate for our recording date. It's May, it's
It's
May, the
May,
last name of the May.
May.
I was
Excellent.
just watching
Happy
Ghostbusters.
Beltane, everybody. Happy Workers' Day. Happy May. Rabbit, rabbit, all of the above. And speaking of towers, do you have a dungeon or a tower for us this week?
I think that my tower is I'm really starting to hit my stride with a new venture I've been working on, which is work writing for the website dorksideoftheforce.com. I've been having more time to do reading, and I've just gotten several article pitches accepted, and so I just really feel comfortable expressing myself as a Star Wars nerd, and it's a wonderful thing to find myself at since we're approaching May the 4th be with you and Revenge of the 5th. So that's my tower. And then my dungeon is probably just I am really having problems with back pain this week, so I'm currently not entirely upright. I'm slightly slumped. How about
I'm
you?
well, you lead me into one of my dungeons, and May the 4th will never be funny for me. And this year is the 30th anniversary of my mother's death on May the 4th. So I kind of avoid social media on that day because I just don't find it funny, and I just don't enjoy it at all. Even you saying it is enough to make me recoil. It's like mushrooms. It's almost as bad as mushrooms. And you think with time that would ease, but there's just a sucky day. I'm okay with 364 really good days, or in a leap year, 365. But it's just a crummy day. But towers, my cup runneth over. I don't even know where to begin. So I have talked about my health a little bit and how, there's been a person who has traumatized me and affected my health. That person is out of my life, so that's really good. And I'm actually in the in-between week of shows of performances of Jesus Christ Superstar. And it's been such a powerful experience to be performing that musical. It's been amazing. And I'm actually really happy that tomorrow is the little pickup rehearsal where we'll get the score back in our heads and get ready for the weekend. And I'm just so looking forward to the four shows this weekend. And on top of all of this, I have something so amazing to do. I get to read and edit bylaws. Can you imagine my excitement? Can you even imagine? But I work for an organization, a 501 organization that has not updated their bylaws since 2007. So at the time we are releasing this episode, it is 17 years. Okay, that's enough time for a cicada, to burrow itself in the ground, die, and after having laid its eggs, and then for those eggs to hatch and for those eggs to come back. So I'm talking about those 17-year cicadas that are now swarming the DC area. So basically, the last time my organization produced bylaws was the last time there were cicadas in the Mid-Atlantic region of the United States. It is insane. And so I have bylaws for brand new, I have got a draft of brand new bylaws, and I literally could not be more excited. I am not joking. I cannot wait to dive into this legal arcana and sift through whether they're using the word is correctly. I'm just buzzing. It just gives me so much hope. So I'm just a mass of towers today.
That's just so adorable, and I will definitely take your word for it. I have never tried to edit or read bylaws to that degree.
Oh, it's pretty boring, but in this case, I'm pretty excited. So,
Good for
in
you.
other words, bylaws are somewhat alien to you, are you saying? This is my awkward segue into our gammer segment, and I hope you'll join in with me. I'll start off by saying alien is one of those words that is real early in terms of modern language, circa 1300, strange, foreign. So it really hasn't changed in its meaning. The old French is the same spelling, alien, alien, I'm not sure. Strange and foreign. It was a noun, an alien, a stranger, a foreigner. The Latin would be alienus, alienus, of or belonging to another. So here we see where there's maybe a bit of a earlier meaning for it, not one's own, foreign, strange, stranger, foreigner, or the adjective alius, or the adverb another, other, different. And we have pi. The Proto-Indo-European root is just al, al, and that just means beyond.
And I
Could you
have to
pick up from
interrupt
there?
because you said that something was, or that your enjoyment of something was alien to me, and I have to switch languages now and say that it is quite barbaric, in my opinion, to enjoy things because barbaric is a Greek word meaning foreigner.
Right, and we get that from the fact that people thought that those other weirdos were just saying ba 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 ba.
That is one theory, yes.
Right.
Also, from the Greek, we have the word allos, which means different or strange.
Oh, wow. So yes, I need to study places where Greek and Latin have similarities. That's fascinating. Wonderful. Oh.
Anyway, the meaning of residing in a country not of one's birth is from the mid-15th century. The sense of being wholly different in nature is from the 1670s. The meaning of not of this earth is recorded by 1920. An alien priory from the mid-15th century is one owing obedience to a religious jurisdiction in a foreign country.
Isn't that cool? Isn't that interesting that you might be Italian, but you are an alien going off to some German monastery or something like that?
Well, on the other, reminds me of several chapels that are established between certain countries and the Middle East that were built by the Crusaders.
Oh, certainly, absolutely. And then there were Irish, let's just say, evangelists who left their monasteries and formed things all over Europe. So before the Crusades. So, yes, they were alien. That's fantastic. You reminded me of something, and now I'm not getting it. Oh, 1920s, because I'm still reading these books about physics and thinking about by the 1920s. Marie Curie and her daughter both had Nobel Prizes. And so I'm thinking, what is the connection between the birth of quantum physics or the whatever. Okay, birth of quantum physics and the idea that there might be other life in the universe. I'm just very curious by that, that by the 1920s, alien could mean not of this earth. That is not insignificance. Insignificant, excuse me. Well, to bring us back to the very earth itself, we have a lovely word in this chapter, buskin. And it means a half boot or high-laced shoe. And this is from around 1500, and it's unknown. And I love that, which to me means it's probably Scottish, but who knows? The word exists in different forms in most of the continental languages, and the exact relationship of them all apparently has yet to be determined. I'm getting this information from Etymology Online. And the English word is perhaps immediately from the Old French, brassequin. Buskin could be a kind of cloth from the 14th century. There's the modern French brodequin by influence of broder to embroider, or from the Middle Dutch brosequin, small leather boot. Again, uncertain origin. The Oxford English Dictionary suggests a Spanish borsigai, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, or bozigai. Not sure about that.
And then the figurative senses in English relating to stage tragedy or tragic drama are from the word being used since the mid-16th century to translate Greek kothronos, the high thick-soled boot worn in Athenian tragedy, contrasted with sock, the low shoe worn by comedians. Related buskind.
And then my question is, does this relate to actually busking? If this has a tragedy or tragic or stage relationship, is this what we have in, on the subway platform in Harvard Square, the guy with his guitar, or, trying to think of T stops. I can't think of
I
it.
actually played it.
Alewife,
I was
the
going to say
woman
I
with
played
her
it at a
violin.
I played a busking thing once on the Government Center platform, and you're the one going inbounds to Haymarket and North Station.
There you go. There you go. So I wonder if there's a connection there.
It says, according to the Oxford Languages, that it is Germanic, but then goes to Italian buscare and Spanish buscar and French busquer to seek.
So that's, to seek. Interesting. So what a fascinating word. What a mess, as opposed to alien, which has always meant other, Then we have this word that's just a mess. And I love the words that are messes. If I'm going to write a book, it's going to be about the mess words. I love it. And then we get the word turret, which is again from around 1300, like alien, ture. Small tower forming part of a city wall or a castle. The old French would be tourette from the 12th century. Interesting that the modern French is Tourette, which is the same as the syndrome, but I assume that might have been named after somebody named Tourette, but I don't know. Tour, Tour, means tower. The Latin is turris, Turris, which is also tower. Meaning low flat gun tower on a warship comes from 1862. Also on a tank can have a turret. And there is a Welsh word, TWRD, and I'm not even going to pretend to pronounce that. But there we are. Welsh is an alien language. Though I live in Cambria, and Cambria is the Latin name for Wales, so I shouldn't say that, but. That was my segue to you telling a story about alienation.
Okay, so this is going to be a very recent story because, as you all know, I haven't been in Massachusetts, or I moved back to Massachusetts last October. And it is snowy, so just under 7 months since I left my old residence and moved across the country. Well, when I was living in Utah for a great many years, I felt very alien. For one thing, whenever people asked me where I was from, and I would say Boston, they would say the same thing. Wow, that is so far away. And it made me feel as though I were coming from a completely different country. And it also meant that I didn't have the same appreciation of certain things in the community that I was living in. It also meant that I had the East Coast cynicism, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things that I delighted in doing was to catch glimpses of other people being a little Bostonian. And this usually had to something to do with someone wearing a Celtic shirt or like having a t-shirt that referenced the Boston Marathon or something like that. I remember being on BYU campus on October 27th, 2004, and seeing a friend of mine carry around a broom and sweeping the floor. And it was because he had the absolute conviction that the Boston Red Sox were going to sweep the World Series that night and defeat the St. Louis Cardinals. And that was perhaps my greatest sense of community that I ever had, apart from having been so alienated, in my opinion. Well, now I'm back in Massachusetts and I go to places and I have this reflexive smile that I used to have for people in Utah randomly wearing a Red Sox shirt or a Bruins hat or something like that. Except it's completely normal here because, of course, you're in Massachusetts. What are you going to do other than rep your teams? Everyone here is one of me. They are a Red Sox fan. They're someone who followed the Celtics in the NBA finals, that sort of thing. And so I no longer feel alien because I am back among the place and the people where this is a completely standard operating procedure to love the things that I love.
I love
So
that.
that's my connection to Caspian, wishing that he were an old Nernian.
Well, I hope that Caspian gets his wish, and I love that for you so much. And you being back in Massachusetts has just made me so homesick too. I didn't leave Boston because I didn't like it. And it is it I am so happy for you. And I just think about the last time we recorded, you had just walked to Billerica from your home. And it's just like, wow, I remember doing things like that. And then you are aiming to walk the Boston Marathon path. And it's like, wow, I don't have anything I can compare to that. That's just awesome. That's just aw and I just love it. I love it so much. So the fact that, I don't know anybody else who can pronounce Billerica.
I was going to
Where I'm
say,
at now.
my housemaid, when I drove from South Station with her to our home in about 26 miles away from it, that place, she asked me when I felt like I was back home. And I said, as soon as I looked at a highway sound sign and thought, there are people who can't pronounce these towns, that's when I felt like I was at home.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, when I
Hello
moved to
to everyone who
Boston.
says Billerica.
Oh yeah, Billerica and or Billerica. And when I moved to Boston, I thought it was Worcester or Worcester.
Oh,
And
my mother thought that we were near Cotchetwaddy Road, which is Kitchituate.
yep. And then I knew somebody who could not. Oh, what is it? Oh, I think it's in the town of Beverly, which is really pronounced Beverly. That there's a road called Sohier, and she would pronounce it so you hear road. I just loved that. I love that. So you hear. So anyway, Boston is sort of a Narnia for me right now because I don't know how to get there.
You need me to blow the Susan's horn and get you back here?
You do need to blow Susan's horn, please, please, please. And to think, we talked about this before we hit record, but 2 years ago, you and I were together in LA, and that was an epic trip.
Oh
It
my gosh.
was so much fun. It was fun to be together. I just loved every minute of that. Absolutely. Oh my gosh, going to the Getty, hearing It's a Perlman, but just walking around and the fact that you knew Spanish, oh my gosh, and the street food and oh my gosh, what a trip that was. That was so fun. And so I'm just, like I say, I'm just overflowing with towers. Anyway.
Now I'm homesick for that lavender lemonade we had at the Museum of Modern Art.
Yeah, that was so good. I'm glad we took a picture. It was so pretty.
Yes.
So good. Oh my goodness. Okay. Shall we get to Narnia?
Yes, let's. Why don't you start us off with something you found in that chapter? Because I didn't find it for the first paragraph or so.
Well, I have it in my second sentence. So
Oh,
his father and
good.
mother were dead, and the person whom Caspian loved best was his nurse. So we have kind of the orphan trope here, and there's something alienating about being an orphan. And being raised by an uncle and aunt, where have we seen that in books before? Even without going any farther in the chapter, my guess is the uncle and aunt aren't overjoyed to have their nephew suddenly on their doorstep in the middle of the night, delivered by somebody on a motorcycle and a cat wandering around the yard. Anyway, I digress. So I see that. Well, and I mean, anybody, even if his uncle and aunt absolutely love him, he has lost his parents. That's awful. That's awful. So I see some kind of alienation in that, some kind of othering, because who are you then? You can never say you're the son of, or the daughter, or the, or you can't say who you are, because those people are gone. So he's cut off. He will always be other in some ways, no matter if he's beloved of his uncle or not. So that was that for me. And then, of course, the second paragraph starts, he did not care much for his uncle and aunt. Is that your first place?
Yes.
Would you like to say more?
Well, I would like to say that this paragraph, it talks about ways in which the uncle tries to not be so alienated from him. And so this is kind of a, I'm not sure how intentional this was, that the King Miraz had some kind of community making with him, but it is, at least in these very early times, an attempt to kind of reconcile the two people who are very different and who are yet forced to be in contact with each other and to make a home of each other's experiences. And so this part where he says that about twice a week his uncle would send for him and they would walk up and down together for half an hour on the terrace at the south side of the castle. So I personally think that it, at this very early stage, there was less alienation.
I love that. And what I'm hearing is sent for him. So there wasn't any great desire. He only came when he was sent for, Casper. And also, there's just half an hour. So if this uncle had real emotional affection, I would think there'd be more than that. But it's almost like that's all they can bear of each other is 1/24th of a day, So I'm going to vote for full on alienation. I love your heart that you see there's a little less of it there, but I'm going to vote for it full on.
Well, then I have a problem with Miraz very shortly after that because I don't think necessarily that this is him being a bad guy, but I can see the seeds of resentment being planted here. He says, "How shall you like that?" referring to Caspian being the next king. Caspian says, "I don't know, uncle." And he says, "Why should I? I should like to know what more anyone could wish for. All the same, I do wish," said Caspian. "What do you wish?" asked the king. I wish I could have lived in the old days," said Caspian. He was only a very little boy at the time. "Eh, what's that? And what old days do you mean? Oh, don't you know, uncle," said Caspian, "when everything was quite different, when all the animals could talk and there were nice people who lived in the streams and the trees, naiads and dryads they were called, and then there were dwarfs and there were lovely little fauns in all the woods, and they had feet like goats and—" "That's all nonsense for babies," said the king sternly. "Only fit for babies, do you hear? You're getting too old for that sort of stuff. At your age, you ought to be thinking of battles and adventures, not fairy tales." And I don't think that the king, at least in my estimation, started that conversation intending to quash his nephew's hopes of some kind of life. He was genuinely curious about it, but he begins to resent that Caspian will not appreciate what he provides for him just because he wishes for a different world than the one that he has created.
Right. I mean, if someone told you you were going to be king, I don't know isn't really the response most people would ask. So yeah, definitely some alienation there. And I just, well, and I also would say the little bit that you passed over, I will now read. Up till now, King Miraz had been talking in the tiresome way that some grown-ups have, which makes it quite clear that they are not really interested in what you are saying. So I see that the uncle is really alienated from Caspian. He's not connected to him at all. There's no bond of affection. This is merely the thinnest sheen of duty. Okay, I don't have children. You're the next obvious king, so I guess I have to train you. I don't care who you really are. And so then there's this whole clash, which is alienating between expectations. You know, so Miraz has his expectations of what a young man should want and be if he's going to grow up to be king. And Caspian is alienated from the real world. He prefers the world of fantasy. So he's completely cut off from his uncle's expectations and what's obviously around him. These stories from his nurse have really taken hold on him.
And I think that, I mean, I don't often think of King Miraz and Vernon Dursley as a comparable, but this is a definite moment of there's no such thing as magic. But the line about only fit for babies do you hear at your age, you thought to be, you ought to be thinking battles and adventures, not fairy tales, calls me back to the prologue to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and the comment that someday his own Lucy will be old enough to begin reading fairy tales again. And so, at least for me, it's kind of ingrained that at this moment I'm supposed to turn against Miraz. He's supposed to be seen as an enemy.
And I love the fact that Caspian is not old enough to recognize that his uncle, well, that there's danger in continuing to go on and on about his fantasy world. His uncle isn't really interested. So Caspian is not only alienated from his uncle, he's alienated from realizing he's alienated from his uncle. He doesn't know how to read the room as it works because he's going on about Aslan. And that's really triggering for this uncle here. The king does not like the nonsense of some lion being king.
And also, there's this seed that's planted of him really balking at the idea that there is someone who could challenge his power. We have these ideas of kings and queens being real, and that there being someone who comes from over the sea, just as the Telmarines did, and having dominion over Narnia. And it's an awful idea to him.
And we don't quite know that story yet, do we? And then I just have to notice that Caspian bursts into tears and the king shames him. And how many men have been alienated from their emotional health by older men shaming them for crying, for weeping? And I'm grateful in this instance that, you know, this is portrayed as a bad thing to do. Stop that noise. And he shakes him. Stop it. Never let me catch you talking or thinking about these silly stories again. So there's, you know, to me, the toxic masculinity, which is so alienating, absolutely so alienating. Good men aren't like that. We
Sorry, I'm
haven't
sitting
talked about the
just
meme of the bear yet, have we?
the meme of the pair.
Bear.
I don't know what you mean.
All right. Well, I'll take this off the mic. Don't worry about it. What was next for you?
Caspian missed his nurse very much and had many chairs, and because he was so miserable, he thought about the old stories of Narnia far more than before. He dreamed of dwarfs and dryads every night and tried very hard to make the dogs and cats in the castle talk to him. But the dogs only wagged their tails and the cats only purred. And apart from this being a very normal, well, not normal, but expected alienation from both the person who has cared for him and also the experience that he has treasured, I love that he attempts to combat this alienation by bringing back what it was like for the old animals in Narnia. And it's such an earnestness for a child.
And I also see there in that paragraph an alienation from positive female contact. So the nurse was a good woman in his life, but Puna Prismia is not. That's the Miraz's wife there. Forgot to mention her name, but we don't really know the origin of that, so we'll move on from that. But that this alienation from good feminine contact in his life is a loss for him. But I like that. Yeah, you're right. He's trying to get something to talk to him. So he's also, I mean, nobody's talking to him. Maybe he gets his half an hour with the uncle, but that's only someone who's talking at him. There's nobody talking with him.
Where was your next place?
Well, we get this introduction to Dr. Cornelius, and at first, Caspian's sure he's going to hate him, so he anticipates alienation, but in the end, he really loves his tutor here. And he learns about his ancestry and Caspian the First, who first conquered Narnia and made it his kingdom. And so he didn't know that. You're all Telmarines. You came from the land of Telmar, far beyond the Western Mountains. So he had no idea about this. And he asks Dr. Cornelius, who lived in Narnia before we all came here? No men, or very few. And so he's found someone who will tell him the stories. So this is not about alienation necessarily, but this is. Also, it's going to further alienate him from his blood relatives, his uncle and aunt, and the expectations for him. So even though he's drawing close to Cornelius, and Cornelius is someone who's going to give him what he's so hungry for, it's going to deepen that other alienation. I love this chapter.
Sorry, kind of just, I don't know why this comes to mind, but I'm reminded of the people who try to educate themselves about the colonialization of America. There are people I know who have no connection to indigenous peoples, yet they look to actually understand, they look to see what their effect has been, they look for ways to repair it or to better educate themselves. And I think that's something that is admirable. And I always encourage it when I see it, and I hope for people to do it because it's something I myself try to do. But it's mostly I've learned that practice from good people beside myself.
Nice. Right. So he is not so wrapped up in his lineage as a Telmarine. He loves Narnia. And right. Exactly. I mean, I mean, I'm so grateful that I know the names of the nations that were where I live, and there actually are people of those nations who are still here. And it's great to be aware of that. I love that. I'm richer for that. I'm definitely richer and wiser for that. So, yes, and it is unalienating. What's the opposite of alienating? Community building. What was next for you? We get this wonderful thing where he is brought up to this top of a turret to have a lesson in astronomy. And yes, he gets to see a rare conjunction of two planets, I guess, or two
Well, for me,
stars.
the description of him getting there is almost the process of alienation, and it's let's see, it says Caspian followed the doctor through many passages and up several staircases, and at last through a little door in the turret. Caspian was becoming excited. He had never been allowed up the stair before. It was long and deep, but when they came out on the roof of the tower and Caspian had got his breath, he felt that it had been well worth it. So, this is a slightly random story, but in 12th grade, I did a paper on the adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and the theme that I went with was the fact that you can only find truth when you have separated yourself physically and spiritually from society. And that is what I feel is the truth with this. We don't have the Mississippi River and a raft, but we have the battlements of this castle with Dr. Cornelius.
And we'll get back to this more with our sacred practice, but I love that that metaphor. That's wonderful. And in a way, it's a miniature hero's journey where he's leaving behind things he's familiar with and going somewhere he's never been, and he's going with a trusted guide, and he's going to be given some new information. So there's a lot of pieces of the hero's journey that begin. He even thinks the two stars are going to collide. He doesn't understand that things that look close from our perspective are actually, could be millions of light years apart, right? So it's interesting because I don't understand my own note here, because he's talking about these two stars, and Dr. Cornelius says their meeting is fortunate and means some great good for the sad realm of Narnia. Tarva, one of the stars, the Lord of Victory, salutes Alambil, another star, the Lady of Peace. They are just coming to their nearest. So I don't know why I underlined that and put A for alienation in the margins. Do you have any idea?
I feel as though there's a reference in this conjunction of victory and peace being seldom reunited in the fact that the Telmarines have had victory but have ensued a state of oppression. And so these are stars who barely recognize each other and they will not see each other in this conjunction for another lifetime, essentially.
Oh, I love that. Thank you. That does explain a lot. I mean, I think yes, I think there's also the reference to the sad realm of Narnia is probably something of what I was thinking about. But in like the victory of the Great War led to us renaming that World War I because it led to World War II. So victory and peace are rarely close together. That's a profound statement there. That it's rare that they're near. And it's funny, it reminds me because a lot of the Psalms are made up of couplets, as you probably know, Catherine. I don't know how many people know that, but and so there's often mirrors that are going on, and justice and righteousness are often paired in the Psalms, but victory and peace are kind of an awkward pairing, because victory often does mean, in a way, an alienation because somebody has lost. Right? Isn't it? Does it imply a duality? Isn't there another, the other word? Like, if everybody wins, we don't call it victory. We call that peace, or we call that the kingdom of God, or something like that. We don't call that victory.
I
So,
would actually call that reconciliation.
what do you call it? Reconciliation? So I'm just talking off my head, but yeah,
That's
interesting.
what we do every time, so.
So it's an interesting duality. I must have been in a very deep place when I read the chapter a few days ago. What was next for you?
For me, I love the section that it says, "You and I must never talk about these things except here on the very top of the great tower. The king does not allow them to be spoken of," skipping several paragraphs ahead. And New Caspian says, "Oh, I do wish we hadn't, and I am glad it was all true, even if it is all over." "Many of your race wish that in secret," said the doctor, Cornelius. "But doctor," said Caspian, "why do you say my race? After all, I suppose you're a Telmarine too." Am I? Said the doctor. Well, you're a man anyway, said Caspian. Am I? Repeated the doctor in a deeper voice, at the same t moment throwing back his hood so that Caspian could see his face clearly in the moonlight. And I love these secrets that are only able to be spoken on the top of a tower.
Yes.
I think, I can't remember if you mentioned this before, but you said something about this being a bit like Hamlet, and that is absolutely what I'm getting the impression of, where we have Hamlet's father's ghost revealing himself only on the battlements.
And then dwarfs are alien to Prince Caspian. He's never seen one. And his first thought is, he's brought me up here to kill me. And then his next is sheer delight. There are real dwarfs still, and I've seen one at last. So there's duality, and then there's unity afterwards. So his own inner alienation is easing here. And it's interesting. I've written in the next paragraph in the margin, reparations, and you're kind of hinting at that with people who actually care about who was here, who were indigenous, and various different things that people do in terms of reparations. And I'm not quite sure why I wrote that in the margin for this paragraph, except that I think, Caspian says, it wasn't my fault, you know. And the doctor says, I'm not saying these things in blame of you. But in the same way, I mean, I'm sitting here and I don't have any family members that or ancestors who ever owned slaves. And, my ancestors were so freaking poor. We certainly were not oppressors necessarily. And yet I still feel the burden of history. I still feel the white privilege. I still feel like, even poor, my family probably got advantages that other families didn't get, who might have had funny last names or different skin colors. So it's, I'm not unaware. So I don't know why quite that I wrote reparations in my margins there. I was hoping it would come to me. The first time I
Well,
read it,
not
I wrote it.
to engage in Europe marginally again, but here's where my theory is of reparations. This line about, firstly, because my old heart has carried these secret memories so long that it aches with them and would burst if I did not whisper them to you. But secondly, for this, that when you become king, you may help us, for I know that you also, Telmarine though you are, love the old things. And so he does not see that he's received reparations, but in this bearing of the truth to his student, he is looking for heart's ease at some point, and he hopes that there may be more reparations or more healing moments in the future, but he has hope for things, and I think that can be a form of reparation after a struggle.
That's probably what I meant, and I probably wrote it by the wrong paragraph or something. But yes, I think that's absolutely that. And so, does that mean that Caspian needs to be alienated from his own heritage because he loves the old things?
Well, Mark Twain certainly thinks so. So,
I do too. You can be kind to the poor remnants of the dwarf people like myself. You can gather learned magicians and try to find a way of awakening the trees once more. You can search through all the nooks and wild places of the land. So.
I'm looking for a quote that I is not from this. What is that?
Are you finding?
I'm trying to find, but I have the impression that somewhere in the New Testament, Christ says that a people who follow him must leave behind father and mother or leave
Oh,
behind.
right.
I'm trying to find it, but I found the wrong verse for it, and that's not what meaning, but it, I feel as though it's more a statement of Lewis's faith in Christianity and the needing of discarding the worldly self than any obvious reference to
Right.
Huck Finn. I
No,
was trying
that's
to make
right.
sense of
Yeah,
the British version
you
of
must leave father and mother behind. Yeah, I think someone says, I'll follow you, and he says, sure, and then the guy says, but let me go say goodbye to my family. And he says, nope, you gotta leave father and mother behind. Yeah,
Yes,
right.
that is
I'll
what I'm
find
trying.
that. I'll put it in the notes.
Thanks.
Absolutely. And I love this from the doctor. I have often despaired, but something always happens to start me hoping again. I don't know, but at least you can try to be a king like the High King Peter of old and not like your uncle. So it's wonderful.
Also, this is a very me and you problem, but I keep on reading the doctor and not thinking of a dwarf.
The doctor, I know. Me too.
Darn David Tennant has been on my mind recently.
That's a nice problem to have. Me too. I just rewatched all three of those specials. Love it, love it, love it. And then the doctor says, "Your Highness speaks as you have been taught. But it is all lies. There are no ghosts there on that island." So they're talking about the woods. So Caspian is learning that his uncle has been lying to him. Powerful stuff. Oof. Anything else for you in the chapter?
Really only the paragraph where it says, "Come, we have been here long enough. It is time to go down and to bed." So for me, that is a alienation from this state of openness where they are forcing themselves to rejoin a community, and that in part is them to putting distance between their authentic selves and the selves that must be displayed in the castle.
Well, we can stay on the tower for a while. Our
That's a
sacred
tower.
Our sacred practice is going to be Lectio again. And I've chosen the text, and I'll read it first. And our first thing will be to listen for a word that comes to you. So if you're not driving, I invite you to close your eyes and really put yourself into this place. And if you are driving, keep one and a half eyes on the road and have the other eye go deep into your mind and think about where what word jumps out at you here. "The virtue of this tower," said Dr. Cornelius, "is that we have six empty rooms beneath us and a long stair, and the door at the bottom of the stair is locked. We cannot be overheard." So, Catherine, is there a word that jumps out for you?
Virtue.
Say more.
To be a little bit gammery, virtue comes from the Latin vir, which means man. And so the idea of using this virtue as the word is a implying a position of strength, kind of patriarchally, but not in an evil way. But it is something that it's interesting that a dwarf is using this as a positive thing.
Right, like virile or well, that was my word too.
Do tell.
And so I'll go based off of just virtue as being kind of a high value, of a high good, really, really good thing. And so I'm struck by the goodness of this tower being that we are well hidden and cannot be overheard, so that there is a goodness in secrecy. So yes, virtue jumped out at me as well. So let's read this again. And just looking at this re bit, little pericope, what is the vision of the world that the text is describing or foresees? The virtue of this tower, said Dr. Cornelius, is that we have six empty rooms beneath us and a long stair, and the door at the bottom of the stair is locked. We cannot be overheard. I'll just going off the deep end here, vision of the world here. Six rooms, empty rooms. I actually get an image here for me of wombs in some way, of potential. Six rooms full of potential. And then there's the stairway. So beneath us, so we're at the top of something. Where this world is at the top of something that is sitting on top of this honeycomb, six, this hexagon of emptiness, which, emptiness means potential to me. What could fill that? So I'm just going wacky here. But that's the world I'm seeing, is this sitting atop this beautiful honeycomb structure. How about you?
For me, the world that is it envisions is one where truth is safe, whereas we cannot be overheard.
Yeah, oh, I like that.
They have room to receive things and to give things and to share things because they have this distance that is virtuous.
Would you read the phrase one more time, please?
The virtue of this tower, said Dr. Cornelius, is that we have six empty rooms beneath us and a long stair, and the door at the bottom of the stair is locked. We cannot be overheard.
So, what would we say to the characters in this passage? How old is Caspian? Do we know at this point?
He's supposed to be a older child or beginning to be a young man, and the illustrations I've always seen have been placing him around early adolescence.
I'm saying to Cornelius, to Dr. Cornelius. Go ahead and trust him. Go ahead. Go ahead. You've been given this chance. You've been given this great gift. And then it makes me also wonder what does Cornelius fear is the cost? What risk has he taken? So I want to tell him you've taken the right risk.
I feel as though I need to tell Caspian that he should value people who are able to hear things, but make sure that they are the only ones who ever hear them.
And I think also I would tell both of them to, there's that whole thing about diversity where we want to recognize it and then also see our unity. And, so there's the richness in recognizing, Caspian, you are actually talking to somebody who's part dwarf. This is your dream come true. So I just want him to say, you have been given the gift you have wanted for years. And to the dwarf then also to say, go ahead, trust this man. I know I'm saying this, but trust this human. Just because he's a Telmarine, this is the right one. This is the right one. And then even to wonder if losing your parents has made you the right one, Caspian. Don't know that, but You have suffered loss, and so have the old Narnians. So have the dwarves and the fauns and the dryads and the naiads and the. They have lost something, and so have you. That just hit me.
Even the purring cats and the barking dogs or the wagging dogs. They have lost the part of themselves that was really brought to life by Aslan.
Speaking of purring cats, somebody's. Okay. Betty just made an ungraceful dismount from a windowsill, but she's all right. Betty, you're not going to be in the Olympics this summer. That's all right.
Oddly enough, this entire scenario reminds me of a word which in English it translates as apostasy, but the Greek word or words that it comes from are to stand apart, and we have this beneficial apostasy of the two people who are able to separate themselves in order to establish this trust.
Yeah, see, that's why a word is not necessarily bad or good. In the same way, heretic really means one who chooses. And,
Yes.
choice is one of our gifts, having free will. So absolutely apostasy. I love that. So that brings us to the last stage. What would you pray, or what would you do in light of this little bit of text here? What would you do? Would you be apostate in some situation?
Actually, I have a very clear example of this. I had a Bible as literature professor who, for our final exam, part of it, we had to literally be apostate. We had to go into a place where we were secluded from everything and consider what truths came to us and write an essay based on that. And so I wish that I had a better instinct for seeking those places where I am free of any other person's influence or any other. Oh, I don't know how to phrase it, but I wish that when considering the great meanings that I look for, that I have six empty rooms beneath me at all times.
Yeah, we all need that tower somewhere, so don't we?
Yeah.
What shall we pray? What should we do? Think I'm always, I think I'm called here myself, again, to listen to different voices, to listen to diversity. And I'm reminded because, well, I won't go into too terribly much detail, but I've got someone in my life who immediately hated someone else because she disagreed with her, that the two women disagreed on something. And what I want to tell my friend is, in a small town, you can't just hate someone for that. You actually have to hear what they're saying. And here, you actually have to make space for them. And in the same way that Caspian is making space for this half dwarf, and Cornelius is making space for Caspian, the supposed enemy, this full-blooded Telmarine who could very well turn out to be the worst tyrant in history, but he's going to take his chance here. So I think to listen to these other voices. And if someone says something really works well for them and you think it doesn't work, well, listen to why it works well for them, or whatever, whatever it is, just listen, So I think that's what this reminds me of. What opportunity do I have to hear other voices besides those that are so comforting and familiar and just sound like cats purring to me? You can't see this, people who are listening, but I've got Betty on my lap and she is purring and being very cute.
Yes, she is. She's adorable.
But next episode, we will continue with Prince Caspian in chapter 5, which is Caspian's Adventure in the Mountains, and our theme is counterintuitive. No, that's the theme. It's not that the theme is counterintuitive. The theme is counterintuitive. I think I'm really funny.
I think you're very funny, but not for that. But we love hearing from you, and our community is growing stronger every day. If you'd like to join our Facebook community, look for A Sacred Fellowship. Find us on Instagram at A Sacred Fellowship. You can also send an email to asacredfellowship@gmail.com. Thanks to all of you for keeping our spirits up and our thoughts flowing. Please read and comment on Second Breakfast at our website, www.asacredfellowship.com.
We also value the contributions of our Patreon supporters. Your support of the site and hosting costs is much appreciated. If you feel inspired to join the ranks, please look at our options on www.patreon.com/asacredfellowship. Perks have ranged from patron shoutouts to literary-themed presents, and we appreciate every dollar. So, did Mrs. McCready get you anything this week?
Sadly, no, but she promised to look in it on the postmaster every time we get the chance anyway. But
Absolutely.
we will look forward to that next time. But
So,
I think that it brings us to the close. And
yes, and we didn't prepare this, so I'm just going to wing it on my part, and you can add to this in closing. I hope all of us get a chance this week to listen to a voice that we think is in opposition and really hear that person or hear that voice. How about
And
you?
I hope we all have the chance to stand on a tower of virtue.
Love it. Namaria.
Namaste.